Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So it's catena occasion, and probably the biggest occasion in this monastery of the entire year. And we all gathered together, come up here, and this enormous gathering, a lot of wealth, well-meaning, a lot of good energy, a lot of happy energy, a lot of generosity being shared, a lot of real wishing and urging and willingness to support something that we hold very dearly. Something about our peace, our harmony, our clarity, something that gives us a refuge in this world of strange, crazy, confusing things. So important to have these places where you can dip in, and you know if you leave your bag somewhere, somebody's going to try and find you to give it back to you, rather than somebody's going to take it away, you know. And people are going to ask you kindly to help or support or try to offer things or point things out to make it life more comfortable for you. And it's all free and willingly offered. So it's a very beautiful theme. It's like the spirit of generosity is prevailing over the old occasion. Generosity in terms of material things, generosity in terms of people offering service, generosity in terms of every kind of intention to help and serve each other. And so naturally, when Ajahn Manindo asked me to give a talk, I was very pleased just to be able to fit into the theme of generosity and offer my little piece to this occasion, Dhamma Dana. It's often the case that when you visit other people's monasteries, you like to have somebody else come and give the talk to give people a different voice in their ears. What we're teaching is really very much the same thing. And particularly this time, although this the dana, the spirit of generosity, must be the theme, and how that fits into everyone's welfare. When I first began Buddhist practice, and my interest in Buddhist practice was more psychological, personal. How am I going to get my crazy mind to settle down and be quiet? How can I get my thinking to be more clear? How can I find some sense of stability in myself? So I began with meditation. I thought maybe this will do it. And the meditation, I've been doing this for 37 years or so. So yes, it's a very powerful and helpful tool. But I think for the first few years, it was extraordinarily difficult to practice that. And it took me a long while to realize that meditation is actually, it's an important part, but it sits within something much, much larger that was quite freely offered. I was in Thailand, and what was freely offered was material support, very freely offered in order to cultivate the Dhamma. And you didn't have to deserve it or earn it. You just basically, if you're able to live according to the precepts, the restraint, then sense of the impersonal dana. It wasn't particularly for me, it was just anybody here, we support that generosity. So I think that one of the most inspiring things that would happen to me every day was I'd go out an arms round. Perhaps the least inspiring thing that happened to me every day was meditating. Because you just sit and listening to your crazy thoughts. But every day after dawn, I'd go out on Bindabat, arms round. And so this was very early in the morning. People were just getting up and getting their things together for the beginning of the day. As you walk down the street, people come running up with bowls of rice. And nimon pra, in order to put rice in the bowl. And they didn't want anything back. You know, just one spoon of rice. Didn't matter who you were. Put a spoon of rice in the bowl. And then there was no conversation, no thank you very much, that was nice, or anything, just felt straight, very clear. Didn't understand what this was about. But I'd go through the whole town like that and come back an hour or so later, bowl full of rice and other kinds of food, and then they take the bowl away from me and then tip it all out and share it out with everybody else. All the people in the monastery, all the monks tipped their, whatever they got in arms around, they tipped it out into these big bowls and it was just shared out amongst everyone. And this is kind of interesting, this, and it was never explained, just something you did. And from that I got this feeling of belonging to something very complete and whole, and which was shared. It wasn't based on performance. It wasn't based upon winning or earning or deserving anything. It was just the free, natural flowing of generosity and sharing. And what it provided was a sense of everybody connected, same family. Everybody part of the same thing. And then you sit within that, sit and meditate within that, and really feel, start to get the feeling of belonging to this world. Yeah. So dana brings us into the human, really human realm, which is mutual, which is related, which is connected. When you come to think of it, the whole nature of the universe is generosity. There's almost nothing, the most important things that we have, we don't earn or deserve, like air. You know, how much air did you win today? Who got the most air? Just the light, sunlight, you don't earn it. Water, Getting born, you didn't have to pay to get born. Just happened, And when you're very small, you spend all those years, mother and father, parents looking after you. They don't present you with a bill at the age of 10. So you're actually born into this realm of everything is given. The stars are giving the energy away. The sun is just colossal act of, impersonal dana, just throwing out energy. If those resources were turned off, we wouldn't be here at all. So the really vital things are those which are given. The thing is, we hardly even notice it. Yeah. That's the human ignorance, is we fail to notice the gift that we're living in. But just imagine, parents, and then what it takes not just to get born. You have parents, midwife, doctors and so forth trying to get you born. And you have parents, brothers, uncles, aunts and so forth getting you, bringing you up, educating you, looking after you, showing you what it is to be a human being. And you get sick, other people look after you. Then you live in a society which can only exist if people cooperate to some degree or another. They're all operating under the same law, the same system. You're living in that. That's what makes it possible. And then even when you die, somebody has to help you die and people have to bury you or cremate you. There's more or less nothing important that you can do on your own. The really important things you've got to do through relationships with other people, including having your own children, living your own life. You've got to do it with other people. And this sense of connection and in relationship is absolutely fundamental to human beings. And what the big problem for human beings is, within that, there arises this kind of strange notion, I am separate. There's me. And I end at the end of my skin, This is this, I'm all in here, But when you open one of these up, there's nobody in there, You have this notion that this thing is me, separate. And this is a kind, no, you can't really find out who you are. And when you look at it rationally, you realize you can't be separate because you've got to walk on the earth and breathe the air and so on and so on and so on. And yet still this notion exists. I am a separate, ultimately separate being. Around that, from that notion, comes the sense of jealousy, competition, fear, mistrust, anxiety, aggression, and so forth. Because other people are not my fellows, not my friends, not my family. They're other people. I can't trust them. They don't trust me. He's got more than I have. You know, he might harm me. He might violate me. She might betray me or something or the other like that. Yeah. So this is the kind of fundamental human problem, that all the other problems rest upon this. The suffering that we can do something about rests upon this sense of a separate self. So I remember a man who came into the monastery a few months ago, and he came to our, we have an informal tea time, people can drop in and ask questions and talk about what they want to talk about. And he said he had this question in his mind. He said he'd been out in Africa working in a voluntary AIDS program, helping people in this very poor part of Africa. There, the children didn't have much food, a lot of malnutrition, there was a drought, it was difficult to get by. And people died, and he was out there doing whatever he could. That was his feeling, he wanted to connect to these people. But he noticed what surprised him most of all was these people weren't that miserable. In fact, he was more miserable than they were. They could cry, they'd have grief, but they'd also dance and sing, and they'd help each other. And when it came time to him to leave after his year or so of service, then what really blew him away, blew his mind, was they gave him their goat. The only thing they had they could possibly do was to give him their goat. And he didn't need a goat. But that's what they felt. As a human being, what you do as a human being, you find something and you give it to another human being. There's no reason for that. It's just what you do because you are part of other people. You share with other people. And you just got to keep that energy moving backwards and forwards. Otherwise, the most terrible thing happens. The most dreadful thing happens. Is you start to feel you're alone. You're just a me. And when you're just a me, there's this tremendous sense of, what am I doing? Where am I going? What do people think of me? What do I want? What should I be? Will I ever get there? He's got more than me. This madness occurs. Yeah. So these, you know, proper human beings, they want to avoid that form of madness. So these, when people live together in these tribal forms, they have a sense of the worst thing could ever happen to you. Death is going to happen to everybody. Nothing you can do about that. But what you can avoid is this kind of madness, which causes you so much pain and suffering and violence and fear, called the I am me sense. And one of the simplest ways you keep avoiding that is you just start sharing things around. Sharing things around. Yeah. Another friend of mine, he was had a, I think a noodles bar down in Brighton. Very good noodles bar. And he used to serve cooked noodles. And also he had cooking requisites you could purchase. And one day somebody drove a truck into his shop and smashed the windows in and stole a lot of things. He was really upset. Really upset. God, you know. So they had to go down to the local cash and carry to buy a whole lot of new stuff. A whole lot of new noodles, new cooking materials. And he went there and he found out that they'd overcharged him. And he goes, overcharged me. You know. And so for even more upset, and he thought, I'm feeling so bad. I've had so much stuff ripped off. I better go and make some dana to make me, cheer me up. You know, I'm starting to get a sense of self-pity and worry and feeling sad and feeling angry. There's that strange disease is coming over me. I better go and give something. So he came to the monastery and made a big offerings to get over this pain of feeling upset and angry. This is kind of medicine. It's called dana. Yeah. And this is the way that once you've really got the feeling for it, and it's not certainly not purely Buddhist, it's a human understanding of connectedness, And the worst thing that can happen to us is to feel isolated on our own, because then we start to go really mad. Then dana, generosity, is one of the ways in which we keep, you know, inoculating ourselves against this kind of disease that human beings are prone to. When I started to meditate, then of course it was very much, I am me, I am not very good, I've got to be like this, how do I get to this state or another? So I think it was the, despite all my efforts to meditate, it was basically the situation of dana that was the most healthy experience in my monastic life. You know, just receiving things, because I'd come back so humbled from the alms round. You know, these people didn't look very wealthy, but everybody one spoon of rice, you know, one banana. You know. So you could do that, and you come back and you share it with everybody else. You haven't got much, you share it with everyone else, and it's feeling suddenly, oh, you know, humbled. Because there's nothing egotistical about it. There wasn't somebody coming and saying, hey, I've got 5,000, you know, I'm going to make a big deal, dana here, I'm the biggest guy in town, you know. There wasn't monks coming and saying, I got the most alms food, you know, I'm keeping it for myself. It was all just modest, a little bit, I give my little bit, whatever I got, share it out, you know. Modest, just like that, yeah. I think this is a really important culture. Yeah, for human sanity, human welfare, modesty, a kind of love and affection that is quiet and non-demanding, non-clinging, because it's anonymous, it's just whoever. And it's the basis of Buddhism. You know, you pick up your book of Buddhism, you might find, you know, A-level Buddhism or O-level Buddhism. What does Buddha teach? Life is suffering. Oh, goodness. Life is suffering, craving, death, sickness, death. With a bit of luck, you might attain this thing called nirvana, which means extinction. That's really, really, it's great to hear that, you know, so that you won't have to come back here again. Oh. And how do you do this? It's kind of eightfold path of effort, concentration, mindfulness, slugging away. This is Buddhism. And you go to Thailand, why are we so happy? They're doing this crazy religion, which is all about suffering and death and extinction. And they don't look like they're extinct. Maybe they're not practicing hard enough. And then one meets people like Ajahn Chah or Dalai Lama or any of these beings who've been practicing for a number of years. They don't look like they're extinct either, or suffering a lot. They seem to be rather jolly and happy and enjoying themselves. So, but you notice they always have a great sense of compassion and sharing. They don't hold on to things for themselves. They're easy. They're lightweight. They flow. They're not hanging on to self-importance. They're not puffing themselves up with prestige. They're not territorial. They're happy to just offer, share, be around. You know, and so you notice this. Actually, you put aside the books and you start to experience Buddhism as it's lived, and then after you get that, then you can come back and you try to reinterpret the books from the actual experience, and it does make sense, you know, once you've got the main thing. And of course, actually, in the suttas, when you look in the suttas, you'll see that the Buddha had a particular discourse, and he developed particular themes as he after his enlightenment. He didn't quite know what to teach at first. But having received this enlightenment, awakening experience, which itself was a kind of gift, he worked at it, but he basically worked to open himself up to receive this quality, this freedom, this release. And then he thought, you know, how can you teach this stuff? And then this spirit of compassion moved in him and said, there are people who can hear this. Just go out and do what you can. So his whole life was then a Dhamma Dana, just giving whatever he could. And so when he met people who hadn't didn't have any spiritual practice or weren't particularly aligned to, they weren't renunciants, they weren't aligned to any particular religion, he'd say, well, you know, he'd have a sequence of teachings. And the first thing he'd teach was dana, generosity. And the way he'd teach it would be like, what do you think? How do you feel it? How do you sense it? When someone's generous to you, do you think that's good or bad? He'd say, oh, it's good. And when you feel generosity welling up in yourself, is that, how do you feel? Is that good or bad? Oh, that's good, yeah. Well, then we'll do that, you know. And so, and then from there, generosity, you start to open the heart, because with generosity, you begin to come out beyond the edge of your skin and to the needs of the I am sitting in here, going, I am, I want, I need, I can't, I haven't got, when am I ever going to get that stuff? You come out from that and say, what about you? And I see you, and when I bring something towards you, I feel this quality of wealth, of happiness rising up in my heart. I meet you at the place of gift, at the place of giving. And then for that moment, we are kind of connected. And it's non-grasping, because, you know, you take what you like, and there's no debt there. And the more we do that, the more we experience a sense of trust and mutuality and so on. So this is really the basis of it, because it establishes externally a place of non-aggression, a place that is not egotistical or demanding. And internally, it starts to get this quality of heart to stop hanging on and going inward and trying to find and have and grab. And instead it gets that heart to start to open outwards, what can I bring forth? And when you give, you suddenly realize you're rich. When you grab, you realize how poor you are. Isn't that the case? When you grab hold, you don't have much. When you give, you've got a lot. Yeah. When they ask, I think it was Nelson Rockefeller, who was a person who had Exxon, the big oil company, you know, multi-millionaire, billionaire, and said, well, how much money is enough money? How much is enough? And he said, just a little bit more. You know? And you notice people who hold on to riches, there's the fear, the anxiety, the insecurity, what would happen if I lose it, and then the egotism. When you've got 5 billion, what are you going to do with that? It's not something that's there to provide you with your pint of milk every day, is it? Or pay the television bills, or, you know, put shoes on your kids' feet. It's there as a little bit of I am. And then somebody who's got 10 billion is up there from me, and I want to get up there to get where he is. So money, when it's possessed, when it's held, is addictive. You've got to have more of it. And however much you've got, you still have the insecurity. You have the insecurity and anxiety of losing it. What happens if the stock market crashes? I've only got 1 billion. You know? Because it's not the problem of the money. Money is neutral. The problem is, as soon as your mind does that, you're poor. It doesn't matter if it does that around 5 billion, 10 billion, 20 billion, you're still poor. You still feel insecure. You still feel anxious. You still feel not quite settled. Because this grasping can never make you feel settled and comfortable. This one, this gesture, you feel okay. You feel rich. You feel fine. You feel flowing. Yeah? And so the Buddha taught this, because it's not something that's so strange, so esoteric, so psychologically weird or distanced. It's something people do all the time. Yeah? And he's saying, well, just focus on that. And like many of the Buddha's teachings, it's doing something we already do, but focusing on it and making a lot of it and really understanding it and taking it fully into ourselves. And dana is the first one. And perhaps most important, what can you say? It's the one that really turns the door of the heart towards opening. until you've done that, you haven't really started Buddhism. You know, sometimes people think dana is about fundraising, charitable works. I don't think Buddha was into fundraising. Buddha never built a monastery. You know. I don't think the Buddha was recommending dana in order to raise funds. For you know, what kind of Buddha received, you know, rice, cloth, and if he had robes, he'd say, well, I've already got some, give it to him. He was not looking to acquire a lot of things. My understanding is Buddha taught dana because he knows you can do it, he knows it's good for you, and he knows it's the beginning of the path. Yeah. And he's anything, he said, and also it's like one spoonful of rice. Yeah. Something you can manage. Because the material thing is just that which is the gesture. The material thing is just the thing you use to get that heart open. Yeah. And when we feel that, we feel rich and full and comfortable. And as we start to feel rich and full and comfortable, we settle into that and the mind begins to calm down. Those voices of anxiety and insecurity and need and grasping and jealousy, they quieten down. Now you can meditate. That's why until he said, you know, unless you develop dana, there's no way you can get any degree of concentration. It's in the suttas. You can't get first jhana, second jhana, any of those jhanas. They're not going to happen unless you develop dana. You can't be a stream mentor, non-returner, once returner, arahant, until you develop dana. Because you haven't got the vehicle yet. You know, you can try as hard as you like, concentrating and thinking and focusing and learning and studying, but you haven't got the boat in the water yet. It's like somebody on dry land with the oars, you know. No matter how hard you pull those oars or how long those oars are, you're not going anywhere until you get it in the water. And that's exactly the principle of dana. Get your vehicle ready. You know, get into that place where you experience a sense of plenitude, happiness in yourself, and a feeling of friendliness towards others. You're starting to break down this sense of isolated self. An important thing to do. It starts to open us up to the quality of fellow feeling and empathy. From there, the Buddha said, well, once you've got that, you've opened it up, then you start to bring the same principles to mind about other people, at mutuality, and you say, what do you think about somebody hurting you, harming you? Is that good? No. If you do it to other people, is that good? No. Stealing? No. Lying? No. Sexual misconduct? No. Yeah. You start to recognize, this doesn't do me any good, it doesn't do you any good, it doesn't lead anybody anywhere good. You stop doing it. Yeah. It's called morality. But it's morality not in the law court. It's morality that brings it back into your own heart, because you establish with morality, you establish your own place in a universe where other people count. Yeah. It doesn't matter whether I get caught or not, which is the law morality, isn't it? Where you can fill your taxes, nobody notices, nobody's looking, I think I'll have that. You know, everybody does it anyway, I'll have one of those. Yeah. Nobody's watching, I'll have one of those. Yeah. And so the law court morality tries to check that, and it never does it? You know, has crime finished? No. And you realize no matter how well-meaning and how elaborate the legal system gets, people are always going to get through it, aren't they? Yeah. You can't establish morality on law and order. You establish morality on self-respect and respect of others. It happens naturally. So this is the case in monastic life, where we keep an extremely detailed moral code, training code, and it's all on trust and honour. Nobody's expecting you. You could get up to all kinds of mischief if you, you know, being a human being. You get up with all kinds of mischief without letting people know, but you couldn't bear to do so. because your sense, once you've opened your heart, you immediately feel the sense of regret, pain over abuse, cheating, stealing, even harsh words sit in your heart and make you feel bad. You don't want to do it anymore. So here we monasteries are always remembering and recollecting every day your moral standards. And so this is when it's come back to you. It's not something that's prescribed by other people, it's prescribed by yourself. And you become a real human being. So a human being, in the Buddhist sense, is someone who can keep the five precepts. Until then, you haven't quite made it as a human being yet. You know, you've got some chances, but you haven't actually made it to the human level. This is where, so the understanding is, if you haven't got that down, then you're just really borrowing a human body for a lifetime until you... Next time round, you're going to be down in the animal realm. Because you haven't actually got to the human being. You know, you had a loan of a human body for a lifetime to just try it out, see if you're going to get your mind up to scratch with it. You haven't developed dana, you're going to be in the hungry ghost realm. You haven't developed sila, you're going to be in the animal realm or the hell realm. Mm-hmm. And these aren't just threats. These are Buddha's saying this out of concern. Because this disease of selfishness can capture any of us any time. So dana and sila, and then once you get that full establishment of that, then the third piece that comes into relevance is letting go, renunciation. Because you feel rich and full in yourself, you don't actually need that much anymore. You don't need all kinds of stuff outside to keep making you feel good. Yeah? You don't need to have a lot of things to keep boosting yourself up. Yeah. You don't need particularly, you know, I mean, this robe, same as everyone else's, all the monks, nuns got a slightly different colour, but we're not going to fight about that. Once you've got this, it's given to me. Some of the people helped make it, they gave it to me, and there it is, you know. It's not something that there's any source of jealousy or competition over. And it's offered. Everything I have is given. I have given socks, given robes, you know, all my requisites are all dana requisites. And sometimes I just sit and look at them and think, oh, so-and-so, that was given. And when it's given, it makes it sacred. Yeah. It's given, oh, that so-and-so gave me that. She gave me that. Look after it. Someone had to work hard and they gave me that. Well, look after that. It's not just, chuck it away, get a new one. Yeah. So you're both rich in your heart, but also extremely conscientious about you, about what you use, how you use things. Mm. What the dana culture does, it makes these material things become sacred. You know, they become aspects of people's good intention. They become aspects of people's goodwill. They become a representation of people's faith and effort and sacrifice and people's care. And so these things, simple material things, bring you into this sense of something sacred. Now you compare that with the culture that's based upon earning, buying, money, possessions and so forth, holding. Nothing sacred. It's just, you go in the supermarket, grab, and everything is disposable, isn't it? Chuck it away. You still got that, you've had it 3 years, chuck it away. You know? That old thing you're wearing, I wouldn't be seen dead in that, get yourself a new one. Chuck it away, you know, because it didn't come from anywhere. Nobody gave it to you. It doesn't mean anything. I mean, you're living in a world which is devoid of meaning. It hasn't got the richness of human contact in it. You're living in a world that hasn't got that same quality of, oh, this this was from so-and-so. This was goodwill. This was her intention. You know, sometimes I can't remember the names, but I'm certain in my life that everything has given. And, you know, it doesn't make you careless. It makes you more respectful of what you have. Yeah. So this is a very important thing to cultivate. We get the sense of mutuality, of empathy, and also of something sacred in our lives. You look at this place. Yeah. When I came here 1980, none of this was here. There was an old ruin barn there. There's an old ruined cow shed there, I think. Tumble down cow shed. And there's this shepherd's cottage with no one cold water tap in it. Yeah. And there was one drain. There was no sink. There was just one cold water tap and basin on the floor. And there was an earth toilet out back. Every time I come to Harlem, I give these good old day talks. They weren't good old days. But they were good old days in one respect, in that from day one, people gave what they could. Yeah. And it slowly, they gave what they could, and we gave what we could. And this is our child. This is what's come out of us giving what we can, you all giving what you can. We've built this. We've made this, you know. And now it's a place that people can share and enjoy and celebrate. This all came out of nowhere in a part of England that's not renowned as being especially wealthy. It's all come from people giving their £5, their £1, their £10, or whatever it was. It wasn't massive donations. And that, to me, is the healthy thing of it. Where it becomes not one person's particular monastery, it's everybody's monastery. Because you, every one of you, gave something to it. Therefore, this is your place. Yeah. And it's sacred because it represents your good intention, your mind, your heart is established in these bricks, this wood. Yeah. Everything is telling you you're a good person, that you belong here. Yeah. And you try and find places that do that for you. Of course, when we meditate, which is the, you know, fruition of the path, you get a chance to, having cultivated like this, you have a chance to pause, deepen your sense of pausing from the onward momentum of your life, the going onward into the here and now of it, and just opening up and starting to explore. You give yourself time to really evaluate what you've been given, what you've brought forth, how you are part of the sharing universe, and how you can stay in tune with that, and the happiness it gives you. And then meditation like that is a source of happiness in which your sense of self starts to dissolve, because you don't need it at that point. You don't need to be or have or compare or contrast. All that can just fade out. You just sense the sense of something warm, gentle, open, happy, and clear. Then you've become extinct at last, and it was good for you. That's what it means. That's how to become extinct. And what's left when you become extinct is happiness. That, very briefly in simple terms, that's what the Buddha was pointing to. How extinction means extinction of this sense of the separate, worried, frightened, nervous, demanding self. And what's left? What's left is happiness. Yeah. Mm. So please consider these things today. Dana is always the entrance to the mutual. I remember, you know, this is not, and one more story. I remember when I was growing up as a boy, then I was in this, this has been 1949, 1950s and so forth. You look around, wow, what's happened here? All these buildings blown up, living in London. Well, it was a big war. People still talked about the war when, you know, everything blown up and people killed. And then when I went to across the channel to other countries, all those countries were blown up and people killed. There's cemeteries full of dead bodies everywhere. The war. And you study history, you realize it wasn't just the war, it's the war, then the next war, then the next war, then the next war. Europe's 2,000 years of people fighting each other. Yeah, incredibly intense place, yeah? Of war. Yeah? And often the people who are fighting have got no particular problems with each other. They just, you know, and it's devastation and pain, death, misery through war. So I was born in that. And then the killing. And then in those days you could get conscripted into the army. And I was thinking, and like, oh, my father, his father, for like the last 200-300 years, everybody had gone, every man had to go into the army or the navy or the air force and go out and possibly kill somebody. Yeah, or be killed. You know, be in that situation of pain and terror. I think this is where I really started to get my mind turning. I can't stand this. I don't want to be here. You know? This terrible situation. I remember reading somewhere a story about the First World War, and there's this terrible situation where there's lines of trenches in the mud in northern France. There's these British troops in one set of trenches, feet full of freezing mud, boots full of freezing mud, people dying around them, shooting away, and about 50 metres away there's these other men, German men, in their trenches, the boots full of freezing mud, dead people around them, shooting away, and nobody knows why. Because, why are we doing this, you know? Stop, shut up, don't think, bang. And then it got to be Christmas time. Yeah. And Christmas time, and they got some presents came, and people started to, oh, a present, oh, that's nice, oh, somebody suddenly remembered that. They remembered gift, and they looked around and thought, I'm standing in my freezing cold muddy boots with dead people around me. Those guys over there in their trench, and their freezing cold feet with dead people around them. Let's get together and give each other something. And so it started with the German troops waving a white flag. Hey, come on, I'm coming over. White flag, truce. Is it safe? Let's try. Got up. Okay, these two people have been fighting each other hours beforehand, meeting in the middle of this battlefield, and he's getting a football out and playing football with each other. And what started it off? Dana. Generosity, the recognition of how beautiful it is for generosity, how miserable it is when we're fighting each other. And we're all in that. Yeah? You know, we're all in that predicament. We can all be selves. We can all be in this aggressive, antagonized, isolated position, any one of us. And we can all come out of it. Yeah. Once you come out of it, there's nothing really that you can't solve. Once you come out of that position to the mind of morality, the mind of generosity, the mind of letting go, there's nothing human beings can't solve. Yeah. We got ourselves into this mess, we can get ourselves out of it. Just like those guys who, one moment, act of faith, get the white flag out, just try, see what happens. And then this beautiful time of forgiveness and happiness and friendship, right in that most terrible situation. They can do it. Yeah. So fortunately now we're not in that terrible situation, and it's a time for us just to use this occasion to rejoice, to feel happy, to know something. This particular Ketina at Ratanagiri Monastery, and we've offered this robe to Ajahn Abhinando, our brother monk. But in a way, it doesn't really matter who got it. It doesn't really matter who gave it. It doesn't really matter where we are, because we're just participating in the eternal spirit of generosity and gratitude. So I offer this for your reflection.